No problem at all. It's my pleasure.
So let's first talk about how you came to find Cairo, Illinois. To many of us, it's kind of mythic, even though it's so close. But how did you find it?
Well, strangely enough, we came upon Cairo through Kentucky. Kentucky was the state we visited to make a series of films about John James Audubon. And we came to the end of our filming trip, and we were looking for somewhere to stay. And we kind of happened upon Cairo. It obviously had a pretty big past, and we kind of turned up there one evening as the sun was going down and drove down a street called Commercial Avenue, which is the old commercial thoroughfare through Cairo. There was one shop and one bar open on this main drag, which is about a mile long, and the rest of the buildings are these were kind of falling into various states of decay and disrepair, and it really just bowled us over. It was quite an experience.
Now, tell me a bit about your time that you spent there. The information related to the documentary said it was filmed over 4 years. Did you live there for 4 years, or what? Did you have multiple trips?
No, by no means. No. What happened was after we came upon Cairo as tourists, I suppose. We'd finished our filming in Kentucky, and we were looking for somewhere to stay, as I said, and so it kind of bowled us over, really, and we stayed there for a night, and we wandered around the following day. And then we had to catch a flight back from Cincinnati, so we drove off, and we stopped off, strangely enough, at Shaker Town in Pleasant Hill in Kentucky, which is a beautiful place. And while we were there, we suddenly found we had internet access again, and so we spent hours looking into Cairo online, the various kind of material that was available. And suddenly this enormous story, this history kind of opened up before us, and I don't think either Nick, my co-director, or I had any idea that we would take this into a feature-length documentary form, but it really kind of, it caught us, and when we got back to England, we started reading more and researching the city. It's essentially a city, but it's a very small city now in terms of population. I think a few thousand, really, whereas at its heyday, approximately 20,000. I think there's the debate about the exact number. Anyway, we started researching this, and suddenly we got some connections with some people over there, and we decided we were going to go back, and we went back, and we stayed for a couple of weeks in Cairo, or in the vicinity. And during that time, we filmed in and around Cairo, but we also met numerous people, and it was really the people who kind of demanded a film of us. They didn't ask us to make a film, but meeting them and hearing their stories and sharing time with them was very, very special, and suddenly all these things opened up, and the possibility to make a film became evident to us, and so we went from there. We followed that up with a couple more visits in 2009, I think it was, and then again in 2011. So in total, this is a self-funded film. We haven't got major backing, so we had very limited funds and time. Both of us hold down full-time jobs as well as making films. We probably spent just over a month in the area.
So let's talk about, too, just Cairo in itself. The buildings, some of the buildings are just magnificent there.
Absolutely.
And then to be surrounded by derelict buildings, many burned-out homes. Did you find out how such beautiful buildings could be there in this community that now is so downtrodden?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a very good question. I mean, that's probably one of the things that makes Cairo so special is the fact that it has this very rich history and rich both in kind of material, but also in wealth. And Cairo's history is a complex one, and I don't know if I'm qualified to kind of put it into a few words, but it was started off as many towns were by speculators seeing the possibility of this land, and then various kind of commercial enterprises were put forward. Most of them failed until eventually in the kind of the mid 19th century it started to take off as a river town, and it was steamboat wealth that really generated Cairo's fortune. And obviously the nature of steamboat kind of commerce was fairly short-lived in the bigger picture, and there was also Cairo played a big role in the Civil War as the base for General Grant's army before he moved down to Mississippi and took Vicksburg. So at this time, this was really kind of the war brought a lot of kind of wealth to Cairo as well. So river trade and the Civil War were both major factors in Cairo's fortunes. And so following on, I think really the kind of there were a few antebellum houses and places in the area, but most of the wealth and the large mansions, I believe, and you know, this is not the words of a historian here, but were built pretty much directly after the war, when river trade was bustling and the town became a hub, a kind of being at that confluence of the Ohio and the Mississippi, obviously gave it a strategic position both in terms of commerce but also the transportation of people, you know, people coming from out east going west, and people coming from the south going. So it was a crucial location, a very key location in river trade, if that makes sense.
How are you and your co-director met when you rolled out this idea and began filming in various parts of Cairo, Illinois? Because there aren't often camera crews in Cairo, Illinois.
Well, I think people have become somewhat inured to kind of tourists or people who come and stop on commercial and just, you know, jump out their car, take a few photographs of these incredibly sort of, many of which have now been torn down, of these derelict buildings. I would say there's a prevailing kind of, there's a tolerance of that. But no town, nobody wants to have their hometown as a sort of spectacle, as for people to come and gawp. But I have to say, we were welcomed wholeheartedly. Then maybe there were some reservations about, you know, people would ask, why are you making a film about Cairo? I think this is a very reasonable question. We would try and be as honest and direct as we could about, you know, our reasons. But I think you'll find, if anybody watches a film, you'll find that the interview footage we have with the people we met and talked to shows a very eloquent and approachable populace, people who were very willing and very able to talk about their hometown. And I don't know, that sounds perhaps a little facetious, but perhaps the fact that we were from outside of the United States meant that people were disarmed slightly, because I think, understandably to some extent, people in Cairo feel that they've been forgotten or marginalized by the state of Illinois in general and by the United States overall, obviously, because at one point Cairo was obviously this place that people knew about. And even famous British writers like Charles Dickens and Anthony Trollope passed through Cairo and wrote accounts of the place. I mean, Dickens is hardly a flattering one. He used Cairo as a model for the town of Eden in one of his novels called Martin Chuzzlewit, and he depicts Cairo as a decaying place. But this is obviously before the war, and Trollope is more kind of fulsome in his praise. And obviously Mark Twain also describes Cairo as being the kind of the magnet for Huckleberry Finn on his journey down the river.
There were some pretty significant issues that went on in Cairo during the civil rights movement.
Absolutely.
And some people in our region attribute Cairo's plight today based on the actions that took place during the civil rights movement. In mm-hmm. your investigation and your reporting there, do you think that's the case?
Yes. From our research and from talking to people, what happened there in the 60s and 70s, you know, defined the next 40 years, but it was one of a number of factors that determined Cairo's fate.
Do any of those racial tensions still exist today?
I would say that the people of Cairo get on very well, maybe no more so than any town. But racism isn't prevalent, isn't visible on the streets. It's not something that we remarked upon. In fact, people get on, and they're respectful to each other. I mean, I think I read recently that in terms of, if you talk about race, the population of Cairo is now approximately 70% African-American. So, you know, the dynamic of the place has changed dramatically. The reputation that Cairo got from during the civil rights period, you know, is one that hasn't gone away, but it's one that the people of Cairo have to live with.
Do you get the sense that there's community pride, because people could have left the town completely desolate, but there's still a population there?
I would say there's a very distinct and palpable community pride. We did a preview screening at the end of last year in England, and one thing that people remarked upon was that these people loved their town, that they spoke with great affection. They recognized the problems that they were facing, and they were quite realistic about the fact that Cairo was unlikely to ever achieve the same level of kind of prosperity that it had in the past. But there was definitely a sense of affection and pride in the people we spoke to for this place that they call home. They don't seem to give up hope, and that's a real quality.
There was also some tension, and I was watching a clip that you have of the film on the website, mm-hmm. and I just kind of caught this little point of tension with the owner of Ace of Cups there, which mm-hmm. is kind of a hangout place. They, you know,
yeah.
I don't know how you define what that business is, But could you go into detail a little bit about that building? It seemed like mm-hmm. the owner was trying to revitalize a part of the community.
Yeah. The guy, Chris Clavin, is the name of the chap who along with his friends, got the momentum going with that project. And it's no longer there, unfortunately. It closed in, I think it was August of 2010. Unfortunately, one of the people who was involved in the project drowned in the river, and very, very sadly so. And they found, I think, that it proved to be a harder to fulfill their dream than they had perhaps anticipated. But they gave it a good shot. Ace of Cups was conceived of as a place that would bring something to the community. They went there with perhaps a kind of quixotic notion that they could bring something to a community, and they wanted to have a place that young people could come and hang out, they could show films, they could have a kind of library, people could buy clothes and listen to music, and it would bring some life to a place that is perhaps moribund in terms of, you know, offering things for young people. And perhaps, understandably, the community in Cairo were a little mistrustful of this group of outsiders who'd come and you know, were trying something new and unusual there. I'm not saying they got it, they weren't welcome, but there was a kind of sort of wariness of the group, and so I think their project never really got off the ground fully, and unfortunately, after, you know, a couple of years or so, it folded and they departed. I don't want to be critical of what they did, but I think they probably anticipated that they kind of let people come to them. I think that was the idea, that people would seek them out if they wanted them, and perhaps that's not the way those things take root. And it was idealistic, and you know, we really wished them well when we met them, and we were sad to hear that they'd gone.
Did you have one interview that stuck out as the most compelling conversation or the most compelling contact that you had during this whole process?
Well, each and every, like I'm being diplomatic here, but each and every person we spoke to brought something of great value to us as filmmakers. I mean, we're kind of, you could say we're quite parasitical in that sense, because we're capturing this stuff and we're taking it away and we're using it to make a film, but people were generous with what they had to say. There was one character, there's a character called Rick Casper who used to have a used car lot in Cairo, and he took it upon himself, he kind of, he listened to us, and he's a very kind of gregarious fellow, and he... one morning he turned up very early at, we were staying in Olive Branch just outside Cairo at the beautiful Horseshoe Lake, and he turned up at our cabin and knocked on the door and said, I'm going to take you guys around and show you where I lived as a child and I want to share some things with you. And we spent 3 or 4 hours with him driving around as he kind of took us around his Cairo, and he spoke, as many people did, with a great sort of a wistfulness that was really very moving. And told us of his experiences and the conflicts that he had being part of the white community and seeing what was happening to his hometown that he loved and knew so well. So he just, you know, he sticks out in the film because probably we gave him a lot of airtime, if you want to call it that, and his story is a sort of thread throughout the film. But, I mean, there are numerous characters.
Also, in reporting on Cairo over the last few years, there had been a fair amount of fires that have been burning some of these homes that were either in disrepair or they were historical in their context. They were old homes there. Did you get into that in the film? Did you talk about it? Were they fires set for insurance reasons? Were they fires set for malicious intent? Did you ever find anything out about that?
There was a lot of talk of the fact that these fires must be arson. That they have to be arson, and why was this taking place? Was it because people, you know, were going for insurance? But I think, given the nature of financial affairs in Cairo, I can't really imagine that people would be gaining much in the way of insurance money from these properties, most of them derelict. I think one can speculate about the reasons for these fires, whether it's a firebug or whether people are, you know, or whether there was an insurance motivation. All one can really say for certain is that a lot of these, the beautiful old properties, albeit derelict properties, a lot of them have now gone, and many of them through fire. I mean, it's very interesting. As outsiders, one comes to I would say, a once beautiful, but I think Cairo still retains much of its beauty in many places. But one comes to a place like Cairo, and one can stand back and look at these incredible buildings and the, you know, the history and the architecture of the place, and one could admire it. There's a whole kind of, you know, academic essay to be written about, you know, the appeal of dereliction and what is it that draws us to these kind of once kind of grandiose places that are now run down. But authorities within Cairo understandably, I can understand this, see these derelict properties as an eyesore because they are a disincentive to business coming in. You know, if somebody comes down and wants to set up an establishment in Cairo, and what they see is dereliction, then it's a disincentive to them. So they're motivated to clean up Cairo from there. Now, for us, from a distance, that's a shame because these buildings are history and the history is palpable. It's so close to the surface. I mean, that's something that we found in America in general. Obviously, history is close to the surface here. And, you know, I'm about 10 miles away from Sherwood Forest here. And you know, we've got that's thousands of years of history and most of it is built over and is embedded in people's kind of, you know, folk memory. Whereas in the States, you know, everything is so close to the surface. And so I suppose that the turnover, you know, the things are built, they're removed, something else is built again, is far quicker, and perhaps people are less cautious about preserving things. I don't know. I don't want to condemn or to say that is the approach that people have taken. But certainly in Cairo, a lot of people feel there is a need to clean up, to clear away this history, and perhaps so these buildings, and perhaps along with clearing away those buildings, clear away some of the sort of the infamy and the history that Cairo has carried along with it for so many years.
In our region, people who have to travel through Cairo to get somewhere, which is typically a pass-through for many people, are told not to drive through there at night. Would you suggest that?
I would say that is probably tittle-tattle. There will be characters in Cairo, just like in any other town, that you probably may not want to meet in a dark alley on a dark night. But you know, I could say that about this small town where I'm sitting right now in England, that, you know, that one has to be cautious. But Cairo, it's a friendly place, and I would disagree with that strongly. I have to say, the first night when we were there, and we drove down onto Commercial Avenue, and it was dark, and there was, you know, one could almost anticipate tumbleweed blowing across the street, and all the kind of cinematic cliches that those kind of images draw up. We were kind of open mouthed and slightly disconcerted, but we didn't experience anything resembling threat or intimidation in the whole time we were there. We were welcomed. That's why when some of the comments that were made when the rivers were up last year and the Cairo was faced with potential flooding and inundation, that, you know, some of the things which were said by politicians and people in Missouri at a time when obviously Missouri land was facing up to the prospect of the Bird's Point levee being blown and their farmland or farmland being inundated, they made some pretty callous comments about Cairo. To be honest, Cairo is a community and it deserves the respect that any community deserves. So those levees were not just blown to protect Cairo; they were blown to protect a whole area of Alexander County and the environs that really deserves as much care and attention as any other community within the United States or any other country.
Did you find it kind of ironic that as you leave Cairo headed toward the interstate, you pass through Future City?
I did. We did. The first time we came across that, we stopped, and like many people, I'm sure, we on our first trip in 2007, we stopped and took out our SLR cameras and our HD video and filmed that sign, and you know, we kind of, you know, smiled wryly and kind of, but then it has a very poignant irony. It kind of, I mean, Future City was never really took off anyway. It was. I think again, I could be wrong on this, but I think that its location just north of Cairo created certain problems. And for many years, I think it was a small, pretty much impoverished kind of suburb of Cairo where mostly African American people lived, and it didn't thrive. And there are still a few houses and a few residences around there, but it is really, you know, you if you go off the highway and you drive into what is essentially Future City, it's kind of, you know, some pretty rough roads and a few small residences, and so there's very little there. But then, you know, a few miles further to the east, I think there is a sign for America. The sign for America is adjacent to an enormous cornfield. So in that part of the world, if you're a filmmaker, if you're interested in history, if you have just a curious mind, you will find so many incredible things that spark off a whole range of other possibilities and thoughts and kind of, you know, it's a place which is rich in history and rich in association.
Jacob Cartwright, documentary filmmaker for Between Two Rivers, which is showing at Paducah's Maiden Alley Cinema on February 28th. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been my pleasure.